Free Energy Now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, see our upcoming lineup of speakers, as well as archives for our past shows. Also, there's a list of call-in numbers if you're listening live. Welcome to join us toward the end of the segment. We do ask that you postpone any questions until then. Our guest today, March 24, 2008, is Hank Price. He's the Vice President of Solar Technology Development for Abengoa Solar. They have recently announced a 280-megawatt solar power plant that will use molten salt for energy storage. This will be a 1,900-acre concentrated solar trough plant that will store the heat in molten salt towers for around-the-clock power generation capability. Hank, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So you have a 280-megawatt plant. What stage are you at? Have you broken ground? Are you almost done? Where are you at on this?
Well, we're in the we're busy permitting the site right now, working on the preliminary engineering for the project. We don't expect to break ground till about a little over a year from now.
Uh-huh. Once you break ground, how long before it's completed?
It will be about 2 years, a 2-year construction cycle.
And once you're up and running, how this is a 200 megawatt, are you going to start right out with 200 megawatt, or are you going to ramp up to that?
Well, the plant is composed of two 140 megawatt steam turbines. And our intention is to basically start out at have both turbines operating close to the same time. Depending on the time of year, it will depend on whether we run the plant at full load or at reduced load. In the wintertime, parabolic trough plants don't generate full output, and so if we're first online in the winter, we may only run one turbine for a while. But the overall plan is to have the whole plant online at more or less the same time.
What part of Arizona is this going to be installed?
Our site is near Gila Bend, which is about 70 miles southwest of Phoenix.
Over by Tucson?
No, Tucson would be a little southeast of Phoenix. We're more west, more to the west of Phoenix, just off of Highway 8, where he lives.
I lived down in Phoenix for 9 months doing some graduate work, and I can attest to how hot it is down there.
Now, Gila Bend, I believe, is even hotter. So.
Wow. Well, Phoenix is hotter than Tucson, and Gila Bend is hotter than Phoenix?
Yes. Not much, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. When you go into a facility like this, what kind of preparatory work do you do in terms of collecting data about the amount of sunlight versus cloud cover?
Well, we've done an extensive survey, solar survey using solar resource data that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory has provided. They've developed a detailed database of the solar resource using satellite methodology, and from this they've generated about an 8-year data set that has a resolution of about 6 miles by 6 miles. And with this, we've sort of prospected the regions in Arizona for this project to try to determine some of the better locations. The location of our plant in Gila Bend is one of the better locations that combine, you know, when you combine the solar resource as well as land availability, water, and so forth. So, and transmission access, which is the other important point.
Right. I was going to ask you about transmission access. Are you going to have to run some transmission lines to the facility? How long are you going to have to run? How many miles of transmission lines are you going to have to run?
Well, it's you know, this is something that we're not 100% certain of which substation will tie into, but the one we're assuming will tie into is about 12 miles from the plant site, and will tie into an existing Arizona Public Service substation, and we'll have to run about 12 miles of 230,000 volt transmission line.
Uh-huh. Is that the highest level of transmission?
No, there are higher levels, but given the size of this plant, that's the preferred size. You could actually run it on a lower voltage, but you'll have more line losses, and so at the 230 kV line size, it's the right trade-off between the cost of the line and the line losses that you would incur for that 12 mile of line.
A question I'd like to address early on here is the price. You're coming in as a utility scale solar power plant to provide electricity for the grid. How much is the price of your electricity going to compare to, say, if you were a coal fire plant?
First of all, the actual terms of the PPA, I think, are not publicly disclosed, so I can't actually comment on the exact costs of the and structure of the contract. What I can tell you is that APS, Arizona Public Service, that is the utility that's that we have the contract with to take as the off-taker for the power. And they claim that this plant they chose it for its because it's economically attractive to them. And now they didn't compare it against a coal plant. They compared it against intermediate load combined cycle plants that would burn natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
Even so, their economics, they claim our project is about 20% more expensive than their baseline assumptions for the combined cycle plant. But that doesn't account for any potential cost for, you know, greenhouse gas emissions or carbon adders or anything like that. So given the uncertainty of issues on greenhouse gas and carbon, they felt that the 20% premium was justified.
So that's just capital costs. That's not taking into consideration the fact that your plant doesn't have any fuel costs.
No, actually, that's an all-in. That accounts for the fuel costs, the operating costs, the capital costs. So,
mm-hmm.
so this accounts for all those things. So even with all those things, we're 20% more expensive than the alternative, but that doesn't. But the other thing is it doesn't account for the carbon, you know, offset value of the plant.
Uh-huh.
Also, we help satisfy their renewable energy requirements.
Right. Now, for the layperson, 250 kilowatts is a big number, but what does that amount to in terms of, or 280 megawatts, how many homes would that power?
I believe Arizona claimed that would power 70,000 homes. Each state's a little different because they have different power requirements. Arizona, the power requirements are driven largely by summer air conditioning loads.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume that would be, you know, help them cover that peak air conditioning load in the summer.
Well, solar is a good match for air conditioning load because at peak load, you're also getting peak generation.
Yeah, that's, That's more or less correct. The reality is that there's about the peak load actually, the peak solar occurs at noon, but their peak load actually occurs about 6 to 7 p.m. in the afternoon. There's actually a sort of a time lag between when the solar comes in and when the ambient temperature increases to its maximum. And so
right. Their
peak load is actually late afternoon. So the issue with just solar only is that, most solar can hit that peak, but the problem is if you don't have storage technology, then the output from the solar plant would drop off rapidly after that point when they're still at very high loads. And so APS has done a number of studies looking at specific to their need. They found that, basically a kilowatt, one megawatt of solar will reduce their peak load by about three quarters of a megawatt if you don't have storage. And so to get the full megawatt reduction, you need to have thermal storage. And that's why that was an important point for this project at the plant. Included 6 hours of storage capacity.
Is there going to be enough storage that this plant could be considered a primary power generator?
That's more or less the intent. The reality is that we are a solar facility, and it's possible that we won't be able to generate, right at the point they. We won't be a complete, a truly firm generator that can just switch on at will to meet their load. However, they've done detailed studies that show that if operated correctly, we should be able to hit the peak hours of their year. They've done fairly extensive studies and found that we can hit between 95 and 100% of their peak hours. Each summer. So they feel very justified that this, although it's not truly a fully dispatchable power plant, in practice it should operate to, as if it were from their standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed in the photograph or the concept drawing that the salt towers, they're about as big as a grain silo, and they are above ground. Is there a reason you went above ground versus going into the ground where you have maybe some insulation from the ground?
Yeah, the artist's rendition tends to make the tanks look very tall. The reality is they are tall. They're almost 50 feet tall. But they're more like 150 feet in diameter. So the artist rendition kind of made them look taller than they in fact are relative to the diameter. The tanks are above ground because that's cheaper. If you put them in the ground, you have thermal losses to the ground. The tanks are going to be at about 550 F and 740 F Fahrenheit. So that's cold is at 550, the hot is at about 730 F, and we will have significant heat losses. Even the foundations have significant heat losses. So putting it in the ground doesn't actually help us reduce heat. We can actually insulate the tanks very well above ground. So it just isn't an advantage to actually put it underground.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of the system, you're heating water with this heated salt, and you're running that water through turbines. Are you going to try and match up some kind of a waste heat recovery thermoelectric type of system to generate some electricity on that end as well?
Well, that's a good question. It's commonly thought that there's waste energy available. The waste energy turns out is at a very low temperature, and so it's very difficult to get any real value out of any waste energy that comes out of the steam cycle. So we'll use the most efficient steam cycle available given the temperatures we're operating at. And we operate at, our steam temperature will be about 700 Fahrenheit, and with that we can have a power cycle efficiency of about 38%. There really isn't a lot of opportunity to, use more energy out of the cycle than we already are. We're using very traditional power plant steam turbine technology, and that's about as good as you can really do at this temperature.
Would those be the same turbines that you would see, say, in a natural gas or a coal plant?
Yes. You can look at this as those plants. If it was a steam turbine type plant, the turbine is in essence identical to a coal or a natural gas fired plant. The difference is in those plants you'll go to higher temperatures on the steam. You'll superheat the steam to higher temperatures. You may go to higher steam pressures with those types of fuels. But otherwise, the turbine is in essence identical to a coal or a natural gas plant.
Let's talk for a minute about the system from beginning to end in terms of you've got the troughs, heating the tubes, et cetera. Maybe you can give us a lay of the land on that.
Sure. We're using what I would call conventional parabolic trough solar technology. Parabolic troughs are a concentrating solar technology. We use the way solar energy is what I'd call a very diffuse energy source. So to get much value out of it, you have to collect large amounts of it. In our case, what we do is we use mirrors to concentrate the sunlight. Allows us to get to higher temperatures. And so we have these big collectors we call parabolic troughs that are long, cylindrical-shaped concentrators, collectors, that focus the sun's light onto a pipe that runs through the middle of the collector. The collectors are actually parabolic in shape, which means they have something, if you remember from your geometry class, a focus point. And so the way a parabolic trough works is light from the sun comes in, reflects off the mirrors, and focuses onto the focal point of the parabola. And through this long parabola, we have a pipe, we call it a receiver, that the light focuses on that absorbs the sunlight. The reflectors that we're using are fairly basic glass mirrors, and they're glass that has silver on the back as the reflector, and then they're painted to protect the silver from the environment. The receiver that the light focuses on is really the heart of the parabolic trough collector. And it's really what gives us our efficiency and makes this a really good technology. The receiver technology has been continued to be developed over the years, and the current generation receivers are really substantially better than from the receiver designs even from the SEGS plants in California that were built 15 to 20 years ago.
What are some of the issues and considerations for the receiver? I would think that you're going to have a lot of re-radiation off, so you've got to prevent that.
Yeah, the key to the receiver is this. The receiver's designed sort of like a thermos bottle with a glass exterior on it. And so light focuses right through the glass onto a metal pipe in the middle. And inside the metal pipe, you have a heat transfer fluid you're heating up in the solar field, and that's how we collect the heat. But the pipe is painted, has a black coating on it, and this is what we call a selective coating. And a solar selective coating means that it absorbs solar light very well, but doesn't re-radiate the thermal energy back to the atmosphere. And these are very special coating. In this case, it's a Cermet type coating, special ceramic metal coating that gives you these special properties. And over the years, the receiver vendors have really fine-tuned this coating such that the latest coatings will absorb, they'll absorb like 96% of the solar light coming in, but only re-radiate about 10 to 13% of the energy back to the environment. So they're very efficient in essence at absorbing and holding on to the energy. Plus the receiver, as I mentioned, is like a thermos. It's the space between the glass and the metal is evacuated, so that we have virtually no conduction, convection, thermal losses from the receiver. So as a result, the receivers are very efficient.
In terms of the length of these receivers, as I look at this artist rendition, you've got rows and rows of these parabolic troughs. Are the receivers segmented, or does one pipe of receiver go the entire length before it goes into a piping system? And what's the fluid inside of the pipe?
Okay, well, first of all, the fluid is a conventional heat transfer fluid that's used in many types of thermal processes. We use one of two products, either Dowtherm A or Therminol VP1, which are very similar products. They're synthetic heat transfer fluid that works well up to about 750 F. The fluid actually drives the operating temperature that we operate the solar field at. Actually, the collectors could, in fact, go to much higher temperatures. Now, in terms of the receiver sizes, the receivers come in units that are about 16, is that right? No, 15, about 15, 14 or 15 feet long. And so that's one unit. On a single collector, we would have up to 36 of these units, all, and they're welded together for one collector. For this plant, we have about 1 mile of receiver tube for every, I think that's the right number, 1 mile for every megawatt. So this is like we'll have 280 miles of receiver tubes.
Okay.
So it's a lot of receiver, a lot of pipe. I mentioned that we had 36 of these on one collector. Each collector is about 500 feet long. And we have about 2,800 collectors at this plant. So it gives you a feel, it's big collectors. So each of the collectors is about 16 feet across, and 16 feet across and 500 feet long, and we've got 2,800 collectors.
Let me get to that question in a second. You've got 500 feet of the receiver pipe running along before it goes back into some kind of collection system piping toward your central plant facility.
Yeah,
the sun is shining across from the point that the fluid comes into the receiver section. It's going 500 feet through this trough before it comes out of this solar trough.
Yeah, the way we laid out the collector field, and this is kind of a standard configuration that's used at many plants, we start with our cold fluid at 550 Fahrenheit, and we'll run it through actually four collectors in series, and at the end of the four collectors, it will be heated up to the 735 Fahrenheit temperature. And so we'll have many parallel loops of these collectors, if you will. Let's see, let me look at the number here. Oh, I've got the wrong number for this configuration, but it's about 600 parallel loops of collectors that it would run through. So,
do you have a way to vary that for varying degrees or extents of sunlight? So let's say during a partially cloudy situation, rather than just going across four sections, it maybe goes across six to get up to 735?
So what we'll do is we'll actually adjust the flow of the fluid to the entire field to adjust for varying cloud conditions. There are ways of adjusting between each of the parallel loops, but those will be set once and hopefully not have to be changed. And we'll just change the flow to the overall the flow rate to the overall plant to maintain our desired operating temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a standard approach that's been used at many plants in the past.
What about the amount of maintenance in terms of keeping those lenses clean? How often are you going to have to go and wash those off?
Yeah, keeping the reflectors clean is a very important factor for us, and we've got a very detailed maintenance program to maintain reflectivity. We have special machines that have been designed to help us wash the mirrors. And a lot of different approaches have been used over the years to wash mirrors. But basically, the basic process is you spray a demineralized water to rinse the mirror off, and periodically you'll scrub the mirrors with a car wash type brush to clean the mirrors. During the year, we'll wash the mirrors about every week through the summertime. This is our high resource period and the time when we want to make sure the plant is operating at peak output. In the winter time, we won't even usually bother to wash the mirrors for maybe 4 to 5 months at a time. So it varies depending on the time of year, but we'll have the equipment and crews available to wash mirrors about every week in the summertime.
Uh-huh. So at the time when you have the maximum capacity draw, or the demand on the system, is when you're going to be keeping the mirrors optimal in their reflectivity.
Yes, absolutely.
Uh-huh. What kind of issues in terms of the volume of water that would be required to do all that cleaning?
Well, it seems like it's a lot of water, but in fact it's really not very much. This plant, we're building it on land that was previously agricultural land. Actually, it's still being farmed at this point. And the solar plants, power plants in general, require some form of cooling. And that's usually done with water. A power plant, even the most efficient coal plant, is only 45% efficient. And so it has to throw away 55% of its energy that you get from combusting the coal. That's done either through dumping hot water to the ocean, to a river, or using evaporative cooling towers, or in some cases dry cooling. In our case, we'll use evaporative cooling towers, and our plant will use about a quarter as much water as the current farming does on the same land area. So we'll use only about 25% of the water that the farming uses. Of that water, only about 2% is actually used for mirror washing. So it's a relatively small amount of our total water consumption for the plant.
And is it 3%?
About 2% of the,
okay,
the total of the plant's water use for mirror washing.
And are you recycling that water in any way so that it's not just being dumped into the ground?
No, it just dumps to the ground after it rinses off the mirrors. Basically, we use two approaches. The basic approach is just to have a big water truck spray water on the mirrors. We call that a deluge wash. There's another approach where you'll have a system with a rotating brush, like a car wash type brush, that will go across the mirrors to clean them and to spray them at the same time.
Is this an automated system, or I mean, you said you have some kind of a machine that does this. Is this how intense is it in terms of the amount of human interaction that's required? Is it completely automated, or is it kind of human supervised? How much human interface does it require?
Well, right now none of the systems are fully automated. So they do require drivers in the vehicles and some level of the systems that brush the mirrors currently require an operator to control the brushing of the mirrors and the sprays that go along with that. So depending on the technique, it may require one or two operators to run the system. In the future, our goal is to, improve these machines so that they can be more automated and require less or no human interaction.
Okay, so we've got the fluid is heated up, the heat exchanger fluid is heated up going through these troughs. Where does it go next?
Okay, so we've got a what we call a header system. It's just a grouping of big pipes that take the oil out to the solar field and then bring it back. It comes back to the power plant, and at that point, in a solar plant without storage, the oil would go on to a set of heat exchangers that would then be used to generate steam. And so this replaces the a fossil-fired boiler in essence. So the hot oil will go through a set of heat exchangers, will heat up the feed water and generate steam that would then be introduced to the turbine to generate electricity. In our case, because we've got thermal storage, we've actually oversized the solar field so that that we're able to both run the power in the peak summer period. We'll be able to run the power plant at full load plus charge the thermal storage over, during the day while we're also generating electricity. So we'll start producing electricity in the morning and also be charging storage when the solar resource starts to drop off. We'll then take energy out of storage to supplement solar output and then finally to completely replace it and be able to run to 10, 11, even 12 o'clock at night, just off the stored energy. Then in the morning, when we start up, the thermal storage system will be, our current plan is to discharge each day the storage system, but we can, in fact, carry energy over from one day to the next if that's what the utility wants us to do. But we'll have some level of flexibility to dispatch power to meet the load profile that the utility prefers.
So when you say the field is oversized for the power plant aspect, the oversized portion of it is going toward replenishing the storage capability of the salt towers.
Yes. When we talk about 280 megawatts, that's the gross output from the generator. That's the peak output from the generator. The plant also consumes some power, and so the plant will deliver about 250 megawatts of power on a net basis after our internal consumption is taken out. If you look at how the plant is sized, the solar field, that is, it's actually about equivalent to a 400 megawatt plant. So it's not if we didn't have thermal storage, we would have to have about a our turbine would actually be sized at larger than 400 megawatts to be able to take all the energy that the solar field would generate.
Maybe you can help us understand how the salt water system or the salt storage system works, where you need to have 730-some degrees fluid going to your turbines, and you obviously need to have the temperature quite a bit higher than that to heat your fluid to get that output. You're obviously not going to be heating all of your salt chambers at the same rate. Do you selectively heat them up like one, and once it's up the temperature, then you go to the next, and et cetera?
Well, the steam temperature in the turbine at the design point is about 700 Fahrenheit, and whereas the oil fluid is at about 735 Fahrenheit. So the salt storage will actually be about 5 to 7 degrees colder than that. In the high 728 or something like that will be the hot salt temperature. And when we generate steam from the salt system, it turns out the way the system is designed is we don't generate steam directly from the salt. We reheat the oil so that we send the oil back to the steam generator. That way we have a single steam generator. Normally the oil is what generates the steam. So when we run from the storage, we actually reheat the oil first, and then it runs back to the same steam generator to produce the steam for the turbine. So as a result, we lose about 10 or 15 degrees in temperature of the oil going to the steam generator. That translates to a drop in steam conditions. And more importantly, it's not so much the temperature, but it's the pressure that the steam turbine operates at. It'll drop, the steam turbine pressure, maybe 5% from the design point. As a result, the turbine will run slightly derated when we run directly from storage. So power output from the plant will drop maybe 5 or 8% when we run from storage. So that's built into our operating profile. And this kind of configuration was sort of the economic optimum in terms of equipment and efficiencies. As a way of designing the plant.
Kind of as a tangent question while we're talking about the system, this design by Abengoa, is this a one facility of many that you'll be rolling out here and other nations? What's the business model? And maybe we should postpone that question until after we've finished talking about the system, which we're almost done talking about it. We're pretty close to being done talking about the cycle of from the time the fluids go through the troughs, then into the power plant. Is there any element of the system that we've not addressed yet?
Nothing that's
really cooling
been
towers.
More or less conventional power plant technology once you get to the steam turbine.
Now, in this system where you've got, is it a completely closed loop system, or is some of the water that's being used for the steam, is that lost and it has to be replenished?
The steam cycle is a closed loop system. So the steam cycles require very high quality water, and generate steam, you run it through the steam turbine, and then at the outlet of the steam turbine, you recondense that water, that steam, back to a liquid, and then you pump it back to the solar heat exchangers. Conventional power plants have regenerative feed water heating, and so it's a much more complicated process than that. Our turbine cycle is actually what's known as a reheat turbine, so we actually put the steam into the turbine. At one point, we extract it back out, we heat it back up, and we inject it back into a second turbine. So it's sort of a two-stage turbine, or two turbines. We actually have two turbines that the steam goes through. a high pressure and a low pressure turbine. So yeah, that's a closed loop. To condense it, you have a separate loop that's a cooling water loop, and that uses we use the wet cooling towers to help with the condensing of the steam as it comes out of the turbine. Very, very standard technology.
In designing the system, was there discussion at some point of using, let's say, natural gas, for example, as an augmentation so that when you have cloud cover, the plant could still serve as a primary power generation station? You would then just fire up the natural gas portion of it to provide that additional punch that the sun's not providing at that time. And why would that be ruled out?
Well, it was considered. Most of the existing solar plants in California have natural gas augmentation that they can run from solar directly, with natural gas, or a combination of the two. That's always an option to make if having complete dispatchability of the plant, meaning you can run any time, night or day, if that's a requirement, then that's a good thing to do. Now, obviously, that burns natural gas. It's not the most efficient way to use natural gas. You can use natural gas in a combined cycle and get a much better efficiency than you could using natural gas in one of these plants. And so it becomes an economic issue. You have to decide whether having full dispatchability is critical. But if you look at it from an economic standpoint, it's not the best way to burn natural gas. And so if you're planning to burn a lot of natural gas, then you're better off to have a separate plant using a combined cycle power system. Many plants are using, depending on the location, if you have a very intermittent location, solar intermittent location, and you don't have thermal storage, then the natural gas, can help you operate in a more orderly manner for the utility, such that your power doesn't fluctuate up and down a lot. In our case, because of our site is a very good site, and because we have 6 hours of thermal storage, we think that the plant will be fine operating without natural gas backup. And utilities, at least in the United States, the utilities are more interested in the green attribute of the energy at this point, and so they would prefer a completely solar-only plant if it's possible.
So it's a portfolio thing more than anything.
Yeah. It's portfolio. In Spain is the other location where a lot of concentrating solar power plants are being developed right now, and they allow for some level of gas augmentation. Now, the solar resource in Spain is much lower than it is in the Southwest in the United States, so they have a much more legitimate need for augmenting solar, as the resource changes. In the Southwest, this is really potentially the ideal location in the world between the confluence of the solar resource and the load demand, and the peak load demand in particular. We have populations, and they need power, during the sunny part of the year, especially, and so there's a good match from a business standpoint for solar in the Southwest.
How many people is this plant going to employ once it's up and running?
Our current estimate for the O&M crew is somewhere on the order of 75 to 85 people. That gives you crews 24 hours a day for operating the plant and maintaining the power plant, maintaining the solar field. So, plus administrative. So that'll be full time O&M staff, operation and maintenance staff. During construction, this plant will probably require over 1,500 people on site for a period of over. Probably over, on average, a year and a half, I guess. large number of people during the construction period.
How far is it from the nearby city or resources? Are the people that are working on this and who work at the facility, are they going to be living close by, or is there a commute involved?
Well, most of the people will end up being commuting, I assume, from the Phoenix region. Locally, there's Gila Bend, which is a fairly small city. There are only a few thousand people right now, but they're kind of in the middle of a growth spurt, and they expect to grow very substantially over the next few years anyway. But people will most likely, most of the skilled people will come from the Phoenix area. Some people will have to come in from out of state, and so given a project of this size, that's usually what happens anyway. A lot of the special crafts for building the power plant will come in. They'll come in with a construction company from wherever they come from. Whereas the solar field is a little different. It doesn't require standard skilled crafts, and so we'll be able to draw most of the labor for that, I think, from the surrounding region, Phoenix area region.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about that question I asked earlier about, how are you planning on replicating this model elsewhere on the planet?
Well, we sure hope so. Abengoa Solar is developing a number of projects in Spain right now. They've got probably 8 or 10 projects at various stages of development. In general, Abengoa is noted for having the first concentrating solar power plant operating in Europe. That's actually a 10-megawatt power tower, that's located near Seville. We've got a 20-megawatt power tower that's nearing completion that'll be operational before the end of this year. But we also have about 8 or so 50-megawatt parabolic troughs under development in Spain. First of those are in early stages of construction. And they're limited in Spain to 50 megawatts by the regulations within the laws in Spain. Otherwise, they would build larger plants. One thing is clear with concentrating solar technologies, economies of scale drive you to larger sizes in order to reduce the cost, and that's why we have such a large plant that we're building in Arizona.
What's Spain's reason for limiting it to 50 megawatts?
And this is my understanding. I'm not sure this is 100% correct, but I believe it's for two primary reasons. They want to diversify the industry and not have a single company take over the entire market. And two, Spain is relatively small grid in comparison to the United States. They're probably more like the size of, say, California in terms of their total grid size. And so they're a little concerned about very large plants being built in an area where their transmission infrastructure couldn't handle it. In Spain, they have a different environment where it's known as a feed-in tariff. And so basically you just have to build a plant and connect to the utility, and the utility is required to purchase your power at a flat price. And it's a very attractive price. It's probably on the order of 40 cents per kilowatt hour. And so there's a real it's a very aggressive market right now with a lot of companies trying to develop projects. But there's a limited number of megawatts. One, you can only go to 50 megawatts in size, but there's a limited number of megawatts that companies can put power plants in for. I think it might be 500 megawatts total right now. Now, in the United States, we have a different environment. We have an environment where it's very competitive. And so cost of power and the service you provide are very critical. And so in this case, we've gone to very large plants to help drive the economy, so scale to reduce the price of power. And even so, as I've indicated, you know, we're still more expensive than conventional resources. So we've got, you know, room to, we still have to find ways to reduce the cost to be directly competitive. But building multiple plants, same sizes, those are ways of helping to reduce the cost. And so that's basically our business model in the United States. I have to say we were very fortunate with APS. They've been an amazing partner to work with in trying to get this, pull this project together. They worked very hard to justify the price of the power, and they felt that their standard approaches for evaluating power didn't fairly account for all the positive advantages that a solar plant would offer them. And so they really had to kind of go the extra mile to really make this project have financial sense for from their side. And so we hope this is sort of a sign of things to come with other utilities. APS has really been a good partner to work with, and solar power is really a good fit for Arizona. So I think APS deserves a lot of credit. Of course, we appreciate what they've done, you know, in negotiating the contract with us.
Just for a frame of reference, I should mention that when we talk about a 280-megawatt plant, a typical natural gas plant is going to be in the region of 2 gigawatts, which is 8 times larger. But you're in the ballpark. You're in a large plant arena. Those nuclear plants are what, between 1 and 4 gigawatts?
Yeah, a typical combined cycle plant these days is about 500 megawatts, 500, 550. That's a standard GE, two gas turbines with one steam turbine. GEFA, 7FA plant with two gas turbines and one steam turbine. Now they'll build, in some occasions they build multiple versions of that. 2 gigawatts is a very large, 2,000 megawatts is a very large combined cycle plant even today. Now coal plants go typically, you know, 500,000 megawatts or more. And as you said, the nuclear power plants are typically on a 1,000 megawatt scale, where maybe they have one or two or more reactors. So yeah, you're right. The 250 megawatt plant or 280 megawatt plant is really starting to get to the same scale as the conventional power technologies. And our desire would be to try to build what we would call a solar power park, where we have 500 megawatts or 1,000 megawatts sort of jointly located to, again, improve our economies of scale. And that's really feasible. There are good regions in Arizona and Nevada and California where that would really be technically feasible.
Well, Hank, we've come to the end of our segment here. I appreciate you joining us. We've been talking to Hank Price with Abengoa. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Abengoa Solar. What's your website there?
We're abengoasolar.com.
That's abengoa.com. Or solar.
Abengoa Solar. So abengoasolar.com.
Yeah. And they're looking at a 280-megawatt plant. They're looking at breaking ground in about a year from now, at about 20% more than what a natural gas plant would be, which is much closer to grid parity than what you might get in an individual home installation yet. We're still a ways away from being on a parity with utility pricing on residential, but here's an example of a commercial scale utility-scale power plant, solar-powered. And I appreciate you joining us.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Your Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.